Coming up on Philosophy Talk,
the problem of infinity.
He's been depressed. All of a sudden, he can't do anything.
Why are you depressed, Alvy?
It's something he read.
The universe is expanding.
The universe is expanding?
Well, the universe is everything. And if it's expanding, someday it will break apart and that will be the end of everything.
Space is infinite. Time is infinite.
An infinite set can be mapped one-to-one onto a proper part of itself.
That is, the whole is no larger than the part.
There are exactly as many even numbers as numbers, because for every number there is a unique even number. You'll never run out.
What is that your business? He stopped doing his homework.
The problem of infinity.
Our guest is Rudy Rucker, author of Infinity and the Mind.
To infinity and beyond.
After the news.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of KALW San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus.
Today, infinity. Philosophers, theologians, and students of nature have had intimations of the infinite everywhere, in the all-knowing mind of God.
In the beginningless past and the endless future.
In space without boundary.
In matter that can be divided into smaller and smaller bits without limit.
And in the realm of pure number.
We'll begin our exploration of the infinite by sampling what has been thought and said about infinity in the past.
Then we'll dig into some puzzles and paradoxes raised by the very idea of the infinite. Are there actual complete infinities? Or are all infinities only potential? Can infinities come in different sizes? Does space have an outermost boundary? Does time have a beginning or an end?
We'll close with a discussion of the experience of the infinite. We'll examine the representation of the infinite in art, literature, mathematics, and science. And we'll ask how our finite, feeble minds can ever grasp the concept.
So, John, let's start with a definition. How would you define infinity?
Piece of cake, Ken. The infinite is that which is not finite. Show's over. Let's go home. Thanks for thinking, folks.
Wait a minute. You've only told me what infinity is not. That doesn't tell me anything positive and definite about infinity. Suppose I ask you to define the color green by analogy, and you said green is the color that is not red, not blue, not orange, and so on for every other color you can think of. That would tell me a lot about what green is not, but it doesn't tell me much at all about what green is. I don't want to know what infinity is not. I want to know what it is. I want a concrete, positive definition to help me recognize infinity when I come across it.
I hate to tell you this, Ken, but you're not very likely to come across it. Every number you've ever counted to has been finite. Every extent of space you've ever crossed has been finite. And every span of time you've ever experienced has been finite, too. And every thought you think is finite, because you, Ken, have only a finite mind.
Okay, I grant you I have a finite mind, but what's your point? I don't get it.
Well, take your color analogy and apply it to the case of number. Then we could define infinity like this. Infinity is a number that is larger than any finite number you can think of. Infinity is not one, not two, not 87, not a million. Take the number of the national debt. Even that is not infinite. What is it? What is infinity? It's precisely the number that is not any of those finite numbers and is larger than every single one of them.
But that definition's worse than my negative definition of green. I mean, there are only so many colors. So you could pick out all but one and say green is the missing one. And when you came across a color that wasn't any of the ones you already knew, you could say, aha, there it is, that must be green. But you can't do that with infinity and the numbers, because you're never going to run out of numbers and you're never going to get to the last but one number.
In spite of yourself, Ken, you're starting to get it. You're starting to understand the concept of infinity.
No, I'm lost. What do you mean? I don't get it.
Well, ask yourself how many numbers there are.
Lots. There are lots and lots of numbers.
There are more than lots of numbers. There are an infinite number of numbers. And what this shows, or rather what shows this, is the very fact that you cannot exhaust them by running through them one by one. Just try. I'll give you as much time as you want.
Wait a minute. I think I get it. You're equating infinity with inexhaustibility. Is that your positive and definite definition of the infinite? Something you can't run through? Something you can't exhaust?
Well, it's a good start, but it's not all there is. Infinity has lots of other cool properties.
Like, give me some more.
Well, for example, if you take half of infinity, you get infinity again. I mean, just take the even numbers, right? So that seems like it's half of the numbers. But you'll never run out of even numbers, too. So they're infinite. So if you double infinity, guess what?
You get infinity again?
Absolutely. So there's something else positive and definite to say about infinity. Infinity is that amount which you can't decrease by dividing it, and you can't increase by multiplying it.
Okay, so that makes infinity that which there is nothing greater than, right?
No, not quite. Infinities come in different sizes, some larger, some smaller. As far as we know, there's an infinity of infinities.
Wait a minute. Something can't be right here. You just said you can't increase infinity by multiplying it. You can't decrease it by dividing it. So how could there be different sizes of infinity?
Well, I'm going to have to leave you hanging there, Ken. It's time to hear from some other voices. Our roving philosophical reporter, Zoe Corneli, spoke to a number of students about their understanding of infinity. She files this report.
After a long day of classes at San Francisco State University, students relax in lounges and cafes. It's the perfect time for a philosophical conversation. Theater major Tatiana Rivas takes a break from chatting with friends to share her thoughts about infinity.
If I think about it, the only thing that would come to mind is life. I don't think life stops. Maybe your body, yeah, physically, you know, you're not living, breathing, or whatnot. But I feel like people still remember who you are. And I think it kind of relates to different things like space. Physically, this building looks like it just stops right here, like that corner, the corner over there. It's just something in the way, but push it down, what are you going to have? Space.
Jamie Trethaway, a physical education student, has a slightly more cynical point of view.
When I think of infinity, I think of school because it's never ending and because I'm still in school and I'm 24. And I remember when I was a sophomore in high school and I remembered thinking, 3 more years and I'm done with school forever. And now, 10 years later, I'm still in school.
Tim Schultz is a high school senior visiting the campus for a meeting. To him, infinity takes on an altruistic meaning.
I feel that infinity has a relationship to helping others, and I feel that when you help others, there is no limit, and it should always be ongoing.
Social work graduate student Sarah Bennett remembers the first time she heard the term.
When I think of infinity, I think of kids who use the word infinity, like, I love you infinity, or I'll be your best friend infinity, and that's the first like reference that I ever had to that word, being a kid trying to figure out what it meant. Like, what's the longest thing you could ever think of, something that's so big that there's no number for it. That's the way it was described to me as a kid, and it was so hard to imagine.
Nearby, education students Keith Favero and Antoine DeFriedman are engaged in a heated political discussion. I interrupt to ask them what they think about infinity. Favero is surprised to learn his friend doesn't spend much time worrying about it.
You've never thought about how frightening it is, I want to use the word frightening, it is that something is limitless? Because I've laid in bed at night thinking, you know, this world is flying through space at X number, however many thousands of miles per hour. I'm thinking, you know, I'm sitting here lying here in this bed, my God, where am I going? Yeah, I've thought about that. It's creepy to me.
The thing is that whatever happened up there doesn't really changed my life here and now, what I do, and the fact that I have to go and wake up tomorrow and go to work.
Favero insists there's more to life than the daily grind.
You have to go get something to eat and then go to bed and get up and go to work, and okay, those are the day-to-day things, but still, that we've got this other part of us, these nagging questions that never go away, and they're infinitely with us, you know.
DeFriedman admits infinity can show up in our day-to-day lives.
I mean, our creativity is limitless. I mean,
I don't agree with that.
Why not?
Because a human creativity, we have a finite amount of, you know, cognitive matter to deal with. And maybe everything now is just building on something else.
Now, this conversation could go on forever, but we'll leave it there for now. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Zoe Corneli.
I'm John Perry, and with me is Ken Taylor.
Our guest is Rudy Rucker. He's Professor Emeritus of Computer Science from San Jose State University. He's not just a professor of computer science. He's a mathematician, a philosopher, a novelist. He's author of more than 30 books, I think, and not most recently, but relevant to our subject today, Infinity and the Mind. Rudy, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
It's nice to be here.
Rudy, you've written both fiction and nonfiction books about the infinite. When and why did you first become fascinated or even obsessed with infinity?
Actually, one of the guys you had on, I had that experience of being amazed that the universe goes on forever, or it might go on forever, and just wondering what lay beyond. And in high school, I think I read a book of mathematics popularization, and it mentioned that there's different levels of infinity, and that intrigued me very much, that we have the natural numbers has one size, and then the number of points in space is supposedly larger, and that struck me as a very strange fact. And then I went to graduate school, and it was the 1960s then, and the notion of infinity seemed very, very natural. I was interested in enlightenment and seeing God, and so I ended up majoring in set theory, which is the mathematical study of infinity.
You majored in set theory because you thought about enlightenment and seeing God? That's kind of surprising.
I think you could really say that set theory is mathematical theology.
So theology goes way back. Does infinity go way back? Who were the first ones to think about it, and what did they say?
Well, the history of infinity is quite interesting. The Greeks viewed it in a sort of negative sense. We very often go back to the Greeks when we talk about history of mathematics. And Pythagoras had thought everything in the world could be expressed in terms of relations between natural numbers, like a ratio. And they were disturbed to discover that if you take the length of the diagonal of a square, you draw a square and you take the length of its diagonal, you can't express that as a ratio of two natural numbers. And then there is a way to describe that length, but the description is infinite, and that sort of freaked them out.
So that's what we call a real number, like pi. You could just
go on
forever.
Right, a number like pi or the square root of 2. And we're used to we have this convention now. We say, oh, that's a decimal. We put point, and then 3, 1, 4, 1, 5, 9, 7, 7. And we're sort of used to the notion that goes on forever. But that whole notion of defining numbers that way didn't really come into fashion until about 100 years ago.
The Greeks didn't think of... you said something about how the Greeks thought of it. They thought of infinity negatively?
Yeah,
this result, right, which, like, that's an actual number of some sort, but mm-hmm. why is it negative? Because if you find this result that you can't express this by a ratio, a finite ratio, right, but you say there is really a number, how is that thinking of it negatively? I don't quite...
Well, they thought of it as a privation, the word for infinite was aperon, meaning not having a limit or being formless. They thought of it as being something like a crumpled handkerchief instead of some nice smooth like curve, like a sphere. So it was just messy and scuzzy, and they didn't view it as being good.
So that was an ugly number, an ugly result.
Yeah.
But now, somewhere along the line in the Middle Ages, being infinite became a good thing because God's supposed to be infinite. Were these guys thinking about the problem that Pythagoras had when they said God's infinite?
Well, there's some interesting discussions among the theologians in the Middle Ages. They became curious, could God make something that was infinite? And they thought maybe you couldn't have something that was infinite. That thing you mentioned earlier, that there's as many even numbers as there are regular numbers, in the medieval mind, they thought maybe that meant that there was something contradictory about being infinite. And so they said God couldn't make anything infinite. And then Augustine said, what are you mean wretches to presume to limit his power?
Right, right.
Good old Augustine.
Augustine was into the infinity of God and I think the infinity of time, but the kind of eternal, God's supposed to be outside of time, right? Because there's these two different kinds of it.
Yeah.
Time is everlasting, but God's outside of it or something like that.
Well, there's one notion that comes up. It's in set theory, they call it the reflection principle, in that God should be unknowable. So if God was the only infinite thing, we could say, okay, we can define God. God is the thing that's infinite. And so there's a feeling that there ought to be some things less than God that are also infinite. Otherwise, we would be able to put God in too small of a box.
Well, let's explore that a little more fully. We're just getting started with this. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're discussing infinity with Rudy Rucker, author of Infinity of the Mind and 29 other books.
We started by examining some ancient conceptions of the infinite. But coming up, we're going to dig into modern conceptions and the puzzles and paradox that seem to come out of the infinite and, to some extent, motivate the study of the infinite. Are there actual complete infinities, or are all infinities only potential? Can infinites really come in different sizes? Does space have an outermost boundary? Does time have a beginning and end? Have you ever been puzzled by the concept of infinity yourself? Join us by calling toll-free at 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917.
Pondering the infinite, plus your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues.
How do you know when you've reached infinity? How is the infinite distinguished from the finite? Are there real concrete infinities in nature, or is the infinite merely a projection of our minds? This is Philosophy Talk, and I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Join our discussion and help us ponder the infinite. The toll-free number, 1-800-525-9917. I guarantee you that won't take you an infinite amount of time to dial. Or email us at comments@philosophytalk.org.
Our guest is Rudy Rucker, author of Infinity and the Mind.
So, Rudy, you were talking about how the Greeks were puzzled about the concept of infinity and this result they thought was ugly and degenerate. And part of what went with that is people for a long time, I think until really the 19th century, when they thought about infinity, they thought it had to be merely potential, right? Because you could keep going on forever. You could never have an actual complete infinity.
Right.
Help us understand this distinction between actual and potential infinity.
Yeah, that was, I think, Aristotle who talked about that. And the idea being, if I start counting 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, dot, 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 so then you say, okay, I have a potentially infinite set. And then some people would say, but you could never round it off. And in around 1880, Georg Cantor started saying, we can treat it as a finished object. And then there was debate, you don't see it in the physical world. And though maybe we do have some physical infinities we're not aware of, Cantor would say. And he would also say, even if there's not a physical infinity, we have this sort of ideal world of metal objects and
but
in there.
Let's stop for a second. Just stop for a second. Go a little bit more slowly. Because, you know, you went from Aristotle to Cantor, but there's a lot in between. Like Kant also thought that the idea of an infinite totality, of an actual collected totality that's an infinite totality, that's complete and finished, was deeply incoherent. I mean, did Cantor have some insight that people like Kant and Aristotle were missing?
I think the difference was it seemed the properties of an actual infinite set are somewhat paradoxical, and for a time it was believed that it was incoherent or contradictory. And one of the classic examples of that is the fact is that you can have an infinite set be in a one-to-one correspondence with a subset of itself.
So that's the idea we explored a little, that I was spoon-fed a little set theory on my way to getting a PhD in philosophy. So as I get it, the idea is that infinity is, as studied now, is mostly a concept, a property of sets, of collections. So you take the set of even numbers and you take the set of numbers, natural numbers, 1, 2, 3, and somehow, by some kind of flim-flam, the set theorist says there's as many even numbers as there are numbers. How can that possibly be right?
Well, flim-flam is what set theory is all about. there's an even simpler example of the paradox you're talking about, and David Hilbert called it Hilbert's Hotel. Suppose we have a hotel with infinitely many rooms, one for each natural number. So you've got room 1, room 2, and so on. And then the hotel is full, and you have a new guest show up. And then the clerk says, well, there's no room. And the guest, being a set theorist, says, you can make room for me. Take the guy in room 1 and put him into room 2. Take the guy in room 2 and put him into room 3. Take the guy into room 3. And so after an immense amount of bustle, they free up room number 1.
Yeah, right. Because they're always going to have a room to put the next guy.
Yeah,
They're never going to an infinite number of rooms, they just keep pushing everybody over one.
So
if 10 guests, if 100 guests, if
an infinite number
of guests showed up, you could still find a place for
them. But then now my reaction to that is, well, that shows there's no infinite hotel, and probably serious people shouldn't waste their time worrying about
it. You think to put it back in these old terms, there's no actual complete infinity that is the infinite hotel. There's just
Well, that's the sort of pre-Cantorian way of looking at things. But I guess the burden was upon mathematicians to show that we can develop a logically consistent theory where we do have the, mm-hmm. these numbers, where infinity plus one is in some sense the same as infinity, and two times infinity is also in some sense the same. And it was George Cantor in the 1880s formulated a good way of saying, well, two things have the same size if we can match them up in a one-to-one way.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about infinity with Rudy Rucker, professor from San Jose State University. We've got lots of callers in the line now. 1-800-525-9917, 1-800-525-9917, or email us, comments at philosophytalk.org.
So, Rudy, just now, let's think about Cantor. Now, I just want to know, what do you think this was a discovery about something that was already there, or you think this is just kind of a clever bunch of definitions that turned out to be consistent? I mean, could some kind of negative Cantor or a Cantor asterisk have come along and said, let's say that a set is larger than another set if you can map the one into the other and you have some left over?
Mm-hmm.
And could there have been a whole different set theory founded on that idea?
I think it's a pretty clean definition, and I won't burden you with the details, but we've sort of beat on this theory quite a bit, and it's a fairly solid, reasonable theory. I think the really great thing that comes out of Cantorian set theory, because you start saying, well, it looks like all the infinities are the same. Infinity plus one is the same as infinity, and two times infinity is the same. And then Cantor dropped this bombshell around 1880, 1888 maybe, and he proved that... They're not all the same. According to, you can find different sizes of infinity, and that's when it really starts getting exciting.
Yeah, that's a mind-boggling stuff. We got callers on the line. Christy in Albany, welcome to Philosophy Talk, Christy.
Hi, thanks for your show. I love it so much.
Well, thank you, Christy.
I just thought I would share a story about my 3.5-year-old daughter, who suddenly became fascinated and frightened by the thought of everything ending. And I came up with creative stories each day and let her spin stories. And finally, one day, she burst into tears and said, "But, Mama, what will happen when all the days are gone?" And I finally just broke down and said, "I don't know, honey. It's a mystery." And she said, "Oh," and then she was fine.
thank you for that comforting thought, Chrissy. That reminds me of a story of a young friend of mine. Well, he's graduated from college now. But when he was 4 years old, he said to his mom, "Mommy, how old are you?" And I said, "Alex, think of the biggest number you can think of, and that's how old your mommy is." And he said, "17? And I said, "Alex, is that really the biggest number?" And I said, "What if you added one?" He said, 18? So 100. That's the biggest number. I said, "What if you added one?" And he said, "Oh, my God." And then he said, "A million, zillion, trillion, trillion, quadrillion." Like, he was going to get to the biggest number. And I said, "Alex, what if you added one?" And then he was really upset. But anyway.
Well, that's nice how you tortured this child with mind games.
Jim in Menlo Park's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Jim.
Yeah, thanks. I like the last caller's way of putting it, that a child shall lead them all. One of the things we seem to miss in this is... what motivates us as human beings to look at these things, at the human instrument, and why it doesn't feel comfortable with an idea like infinity. And if it's in science, you had in quantum mechanics, they started looking at why an electron was traveling the way it did around the nucleus of an atom, and then they started looking at maybe how we were influencing that. And that started the process of looking back at the human instrument as to why it ponders the concepts like infinity or eternity. And when we do that, we can look into a finite reality of understanding our motivation. It's very, very easily understood, our motivation for looking at these things, and therefore we can get at what you might say is a concrete answer or piece from the very question of infinity.
Thanks, Jim. Rudy, what's your thought about that?
Well, maybe what he's getting at is that notions of infinity are related to the human religious impulse, and there's something to that. George Cantor himself distinguished three kinds of infinity. He talked about the mental infinities in our mind, the physical infinities that might be in the universe, and then he also spoke about the notion of an absolute infinite being something larger than anything you could possibly conceive of, and which in some measure shares some of the qualities of God.
So, Rudy, thinking of these levels of infinity. Now, I'm going to show I'm a good student or bad student. I'm not sure which here. But we've said that sets are the same size if they can be put into one-to-one correspondence. And that uses, that we show then that a set is infinite if it can be put into one-to-one correspondence with its parts. So I guess if you had two sets that met that definition, but they couldn't be put into one-to-one correspondence, then you'd have shown that there's two infinities.
Very clearly.
But, okay, that's as far as I get. I can't think of any. Mm. What is a good example?
Well, think of the real numbers. Think of the points on the number line between 0 and 1. So each of those I could write as a decimal of the form 0.17 whatever, you know, or 0.3333. And so then say, could I list those things in a list matching the natural numbers, a first one, a second one, a third one? And Cantor formulated the so-called diagonal argument. And he said, suppose you take a list of these decimal numbers, you can always find a number that's not in the list. And the trick involves going down the diagonal. Make sure it differs from the first one in the first decimal place, the second one in the second decimal place, the third in the third decimal place. And you can whip out there and you come up with a number that's not in the list. And you can always do this. Therefore, the set of real numbers is larger than the set of natural numbers.
So this little bit of hocus pocus.
Ledger domain.
Yeah, ledger domain. Goes back to Pythagoras. So history's kind of coming around. I mean, because it's the fact that you take an endless number of digits to write out pi is what makes this argument work.
Exactly. And that you can sort of see that's why infinity's building on itself.
So 1-800-525-9917 or email us at comment@philosophytalk.org. Now, I want to pressure on a different kind of point, change the subject slightly. I understand the mathematical concept of infinity. I spent a fair amount of time digging into that in my youth and being fascinated by the set theory and large cardinals and all that, right? I understand the kind of religious motivation. Right, you think the world is a finite thing. It's got to have a source. It's got to have a source that's not finite, because you know. And you think about time. But here's a question for you: is infinity just a mathematical or religious concept? Are there really any real physical infinities? I mean, you might think there must be one: the infinite divisibility of space, or something. So there's an infinitely small point in space, or the infinite extendability of space, or something. But
that's an area that's always fascinated me. It's like we've got this beautiful science of the infinite, and the physicists haven't latched onto it. And you mentioned the trouble is quantum mechanics. I remember the mathematics popularizer, Martin Gardner. I was once talking to him, and he said, sadly, quantum mechanics ruins everything. And when you want to talk about infinite divisibility of matter, then they say, well, once you get down to 10 to the minus 43rd meters, space turns into this foam, and it doesn't even make sense to talk about dividing it. And that's sort of a killjoy attitude.
And time doesn't go infinitely back, because the universe has a big bang.
Well, the cosmologists, it's amazing how rapidly they change their minds. I mean, you think everything's nailed down, and then you stop paying attention for 5 years, and you come back, and now they say the universe is expanding forever, so time might go on forever. And it used to be that they said if the universe expands forever, that means there's infinitely many stars. So they're not quite saying that yet, but that seems to be back on the table.
So I don't know. Are there infinities in the physical world or not? Are they only in the mathematical world or in the spiritual world and not in the physical world?
Well, I'm optimistic about it. I think the Planck limit down at 10 to minus 43rd meters is maybe just a sort of something that we can go through. And I'd like to imagine that there's infinitely many levels of matter beneath there, so we would have infinite divisibility.
We've got callers on the line, 1-800-525-9917, or email us comments@philosophytalk.org. And Bill in San Francisco, welcome to Philosophy Talk, Bill.
Hi, I just have a simple question. If you could compare, contrast, or what is the difference between zero and infinity? If you multiply 2 times 0, you still get 0. Multiply 2 times infinity, you still get infinity.
That's a cute question. Intellectually, sometimes I also think of thinking about infinity as a form of meditation. And there's two schools of meditation, where one is where you try to visualize 0, and the other is where you try to visualize infinity. That is, you try to throw everything out of your mind and think nothing at all, or you try to encompass the entire cosmos. And there's a certain duality there, and 1 over infinity is 0, so They're friends from way
yeah,
back.
Yeah, yeah, but zero is not larger than every finite number, so there's right. a big difference
it's
right
smaller.
There.
Smaller.
Yeah, well, not that well, every finite number positive zero. Number. Okay, yeah. John, you got an email
yeah.
there, I
yeah,
think.
Yeah, Claudia wants to talk a little more about the hotel example. She says, it occurs to me that in your hotel example, the last customer, the room number infinity, would not have to change rooms. Isn't room infinity plus one the same as room infinity? Or maybe they're adjoining rooms. I mean.
Well, if we can have a... In my novel, White Light, I wrote about a mountain that goes on past every level of infinity. And we could actually, you could squeeze before room infinity, all the hustle and bustle would be down there and you'd fit the other person in. But then the guy at room infinity wouldn't have to be disturbed. But then, of course, there's an infinite sequence of rooms beyond that. There's room infinity plus one, infinity plus two. There's different. It's a subtle distinction.
It'd be a long time before he would be disturbed.
Yeah.
Well, if you want to do things, you want to take advantage of Zeno, and you do the first move in half a second, the second move in a quarter of a second, the third move in an eighth of a second.
Did we start out with nobody in room infinity plus one? Is that how this went? When we filled up all the rooms?
We don't have to bother that guy.
So you mentioned Zeno. Maybe we should... think of at least one of Zeno's paradoxes to make the show kind of
sure,
well-rounded
yeah,
historically.
Yeah, I should have talked about Zeno. And his famous example is that you can fit an infinite sequence into a finite interval. Or like to get to the door, you go halfway there, then you go half the remaining distance, then you go half the remaining distance, and you actually have to carry out an infinite sequence of actions to get there. But yet you're able to do it. And the trick is that each of those successive actions is done twice as fast as the one before.
But his mistake was, I think, that he thought that if you summed an infinite number of things, you had to get infinity, right? So there are infinite number of smaller and smaller intervals, and he thought the sum of those had to be infinity, and he didn't understand the notion of a limit, but maybe we can talk about that more after the break.
Sure.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're discussing infinity with Rudy Rucker from San Jose State University.
We've been exploring the nature of infinity. Next, we're going to dig into the experience, cognition, and representation of infinity in areas as diverse as art, literature, science, religion, and mathematics. Can our feeble, finite minds really grasp, experience, or even explain the infinite?
Experiencing and explaining the infinite when Philosophy Talk continues.
Infinity. What would it be like to experience the infinite? How can our feeble, finite minds even hope to understand, let alone explain, the infinite? I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. Our guest is Rudy Rucker, author of Infinity of the Mind and lots of other books.
Rudy, we've been talking a lot about the nature of the infinite, but now let's ask about our experience and cognition of the infinite. How can small, limited brains like, you know, we say we question everything except our listeners' intelligence, but we keep saying they got finite minds. But anyway, putting that aside, how can our small, limited brains possibly grasp the nature of this elusive thing we call the infinite?
Well, one example you might think of is in perspective. When you do a perspective painting, you can actually represent an infinite railroad track by having it dwindle to this point on the horizon. So we do things like that. We have we sort of summarize the infinite concept by a finite point. In my science fiction, sometimes I try to write about people that are doing infinite things, and I tend there very often to fall back on what I call a Zeno speed up, where they can do, as we were discussing before the break, they can do one thing in half a second, the next thing in a quarter of a second, the next in an eighth, and as Ken mentioned, that actually sums only to a second. It's not really a paradox. It's just strange.
Yeah, yeah. But it sounds... Do you think the case that in the 19th century with Cantor and since then, we've grasped the infinite in a new way? Because you think about all the other... It's back to this potential versus indefinite. Even your perspective painting. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a representation of something not terminating and going to a terminus but never mm-hmm. reaching mm-hmm. there. I mean, is that the only way we can really grasp the infinite, you know? I mean, John keeps calling Cantor magical or something, or a sleight of hand, when you say, take the totality. But does that really make any sense?
I think it would be nice if the physicists came through for us and we started saying, well, there's different levels of the transfinite. There's Cantor made up these wonderful names for them. He used the Hebrew alphabet because I think it sounds sort of Kabbalistic and mysterious. And the first letter of the alphabet is Aleph. And so he has Aleph Null and then Aleph 1 and Aleph 2. And it would be very cool if you could say something like an electron is an Aleph 1 condensation point and a proton is an Aleph 2 point.
But you can't so far. You know, we've got a caller on the line who wants to ask us about a kind of number. I've heard of lots of different numbers, transfinite cardinals, imaginary numbers, real numbers. Philip in San Francisco, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Hi. I want to start to Rucker. I read this article years ago in Discover magazine, and I've forgotten the core of it, but I remember this was really gave me a strange feeling that stayed with me, and it was about surreal numbers.
Right.
And it was about infinity and the surreal with those particular numbers, and it also said there's plenty of things we need numbers like these for and other kinds of numbers like them. And I'd like to ask him that. Basically, what are surreal numbers and why do we need more and other kinds of numbers? Haven't we got plenty already?
Thanks for the call, Philip.
Yeah, those were they were invented by the mathematician John Horton Conway, who's also famous for inventing the game of life, computer graphic. And Donald Knuth, a computer scientist, helped him popularize this notion. And in a nutshell, the idea is we have Cantor's transfinites like Aleph 0, Aleph 1, Aleph 2, Aleph 7. And then Conway and Knuth said, well, let's beef up our number system so we can take the reciprocals of them. So rather than instead of just saying 1 over infinity is 0, let's say 1 over Aleph null is one tiny little number. 1 over Aleph 1 is a slightly smaller number. 1 over Aleph 2 is even smaller.
Are they smaller than like the smallest real?
The smallest real number, you could have like 0.0, 0.00, 0.001.
Right.
You'd sort of have maybe Aleph null zeros and then a 1 or Aleph 1
ones. My mind's getting boggled here. John, you got an email.
Yeah, we have another interesting email. This is Mike from Pasadena, and he says, infinity is by definition something we cannot fully perceive, and yet we have a word for it. But I wonder if having a word for something really implies our knowledge of it, or is it ultimately a delusion?
There are people who are finitists who think that these notions of infinity should be banished from mathematics.
Well, George Cantor was always fighting people like that. He says it's a form of myopia or short-sightedness that destroys the possibility of seeing the truth. You're afraid of something, so you just shout that it doesn't exist and you refuse to look out the window. But if you let set theory open your mind, you can see these things very clearly.
So now you obviously love the infinite.
Oh, yeah.
But you are, at least by profession, your day job for a long time was being a computer scientist.
That's right. And it's quite a come down from infinity to 256K. Yeah.
The physicists haven't done what you want and really recognized the necessity for a real infinite thing. How about computer science? Does it need the infinite, and how's it going to get it?
Well, it's sometimes we dream about new kinds of computer science. There's like quantum computation, or people talk about what if we can build a computer that can travel back in time. There's an interesting article in the Scientific American this month about fantastic types of computers. And certainly if we could have a computer that could use Zeno speedups and do an infinite number of steps.
So in other words, you get Intel to build a computer or chip that does the first instruction and then the second instruction half that time.
Exactly.
Have you got a patent on that?
Well, see, then instead of having to write my next novel, I simply feed in the previous 16 and have it search through the all possible novels to find one that would appear to be a reasonable successor.
Some religious people think that they have a kind of experience of the infinite in contemplating the universe in awe and wonder. I'm not quite sure what it would be like to experience the infinite, but lots of religious traditions have this idea.
Yes.
What do you make of that idea?
Well, in the 1960s, we called it the white light. It was this this thing of fusing into this blinding white light of mystical enlightenment. And whether or not it was potentiated by meditation or more worldly means, the feeling was there's something there. And at various times in your life, you will have this sensation of a union with the cosmos, at the very least. And that's sort of one of the driving kind of emotional reasons that keeps me at least interested in infinity, is this idea that I've always been afraid of dying from my earliest years, and the hope that there's something beyond that, that I can connect with. And so that's sort of...
Maybe your mathematical explorations of infinity, I just had this thought for the first time. When you really dig into all these complicated technical notions of infinity, maybe they help prepare the way somehow to experience the infinity. I mean, because you might think that this religious experience of the infinity is one thing, and this mathematical cognition of infinite sets, right? But maybe the one gives real content to the other. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I really do have that feeling. At the beginning of the hour, I said, in a way, set theory is an exact form of theology. And it is a way of removing like these notions that it's, I can't even think about it, it doesn't make sense, it's incoherent. And then you do the mathematics, you say, well, there actually could be something there. And it does, as you say, open your mind to the possibility of perceiving the absolute.
So on the Friends of Infinity side, we've got an email from Fred Ide, and then I want to add my 2 cents at the end. Fred says, here's my take on infinity. If a geometrical point is infinitely small, and if all physical points contain geometrical points, therefore all physical objects are infinite, we live in the infinite. It's all around us for any eye to see. So my follow-up is this. Aren't these physicists being a little duplicitous? I mean, because they use the calculus. They love the calculus, and calculus has limits. And isn't that really borrowing the infinite there?
Oh, yeah. The physicists, they're complete sleazebags. Cantor himself said infinity surrounds us, and he actually worked out a theory, which unfortunately doesn't seem to have been true, but he said, well, physical matter is made of Aleph zero points, and things like electrical fields are made of Aleph one points, and it was sort of the beginning of this thing that is still my dream, that there might be the different levels of infinity would correspond to different
but
physical.
Here's another Zeno's paradox, though, right? Take an extensionless point and put a whole bunch of extensionless points together. Mm-hmm. What do you get? No extension, because 0 plus 0 equals 0.
Yes.
Right? Well, and obviously there is extension,
yes,
but it's not because extension is made up of an infinity of points. An infinity of points gives you no extension. So extension has to be something beyond, right?
It's a tough paradox. It really is. And maybe if you have Aleph null points, they do add up. Or you could go into the surreal number mode and say, okay, we actually have absolutely infinitely many points.
But my point was trying to say the infinite divisibility of the number line doesn't entail anything about the infinite divisibility of space.
Right.
Because the infinite points doesn't give you extension. Extension is something else.
Yes.
We don't quite know what that something else is, but it's something else.
You said a little Aristotelian here. You really want to just keep the potential infinite.
Well, there is this thing of, we do have the mathematical notion of infinitely many points in space, but whether that matches what's going down in the very small regions of physical space is something that's really up for grabs.
Yeah, and I guess we're still grappling with that. I mean, it's the worries about this that led to the early Greek atomists, right, to say there must be a atom that can't be divided any further.
Yeah, atom means no cut.
Right.
So there you go. Yeah.
that definition didn't turn out to stick with Adam, though. Because
well, that's They keep finding new stuff. I mean, you've got the quarks, you've got the gluons.
And well, they really are sleazebags. They can't even stick with the Greek definition of their basic term.
But so, Rudy, I'll give you a chance for one last comment. Maybe about the experience of infinity, since you've told me one last thing about the experience of infinity.
Well, it's... I like this idea of getting into my head and going out into the infinite. It's... just recently, I've been writing a story about somebody that leaves his body and goes out beyond the furthest galaxy, and then can do things like count infinitely many numbers on a tree. And I like getting into these worlds.
Well, on that note, I'm going to have to thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. It's been really interesting.
Our guest has been Rudy Rucker, Professor Emeritus of Computer Science at San Jose State University, author of many things, including Infinity of the Mind, but also many novels and other accessible books. So, John, what did you learn today?
What did I learn today? Well, I kind of was reminded of a number of things I've learned or almost learned in the past, and it kind of came to the same conclusion. On the one hand, our last emailer, Fred Ide, seemed to me to have a really compelling point. I mean, if it's hard for me to imagine that space isn't infinitely divisible, and if so, if a physical object takes up some space, in a way we've got a completed infinity in front of us.
Well, right.
On the other hand, all the arguments that Cantor gives us are always impressive, and you know, airtight, but they always do have a little air of hocus pocus about them.
Yeah.
What'd you learn?
Well, I mean, I was fascinated by lots of things that Rudy said. I learned a lot, you know, and I learned that you could be a rigorous, hard-thinking, mathematically sophisticated, computationally sophisticated guy, and also be, you know, kind of a mushy transcendentalist kind of thing. That these two things don't necessarily, that they actually can complement each other. I thought that was actually fascinating, the idea that, you know, because you think of the religious traditions and thinking about infinity, and you think that's kind of mystical. Right? Mm-hmm. And all about experience. But then you think, well, the mathematical thinking about affinity works out some of the potential content of that mystical experience, and maybe they can be put together.
So are you on the verge of being the first person converted to religion by set theory?
No, I wouldn't say that. It would take a little bit more for me to do that. But you know what? This conversation continues on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is Cogito Ergo Blogo. Now, our blog has been lacking a bit in recent days, but we're going to get back to that thing. I promise you we'll get back to that.
I was going to blog on infinity, but then I got an infinitely bad cold, and
yeah.
I've just been sleeping most of the time since then. But, you know, for the final word on infinity, can you have a final word on infinity? Well, at any rate, for the final word on infinity, we turn to the fast, although not infinitely fast-talking, Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, nowadays infinity is pretty much taken for granted, at least in the world of mathematics. Good old-fashioned wonder, staring up at the stars, is still around, of course, but most of the time infinity is an excuse to invent thought experiments, paradoxes, riddles, and metaphors. The one thought experiment that puzzled me the most is the one that posits that if you had a monkey and a typewriter with an infinite amount of time, the monkey would eventually write Hamlet. Well, first of all, why a monkey? Why not a duck or even a human being? Now, it'd probably be less likely that an infinite human would write Hamlet because he would be trying to write Hamlet based on having read the Cliff Notes in high school. In infinite monkey world, I would suggest, it would be easier to write Hamlet by accident than intent. Still, what is it with monkeys? It's not just in thought experiments. Monkeys show up everywhere. There's monkey as moral arbiter. Monkey see, monkey do. They hear no evil, see no evil, speak no evil monkeys. On the other hand, sex is sometimes called monkeying around. If you're an addict, you have a monkey on your back. A barrel of monkeys is that against which all fun is measured. The brass monkey, and body part of same, is that against which great cold is measured. Mischief is monkey shines. When you go to stop something in its tracks, what do you throw into it? A monkey wrench. And we have monkey business, sock monkeys, monkey's uncle, monkey bars, cheeky monkeys, sea monkeys, grease monkeys, code monkeys, monkey business, the signifying monkey, unless we forget, if you pay peanuts, you get monkeys. Don't make a monkey out of me. And there's this funny monkey. Dr. Lyle Watson, in his 1979 book Lifetide, wrote, quote, "An unspecified number of monkeys on Koshima were washing sweet potatoes in the sea. Let us say, for argument's sake, that the number was 99, and at 11 o'clock on a Tuesday morning, one further convert was added to the fold in the usual way. But the addition of the 100th monkey apparently carried the number across some sort of threshold, pushing it through a kind of critical mass, because by that evening, almost everyone was doing it," unquote. This led to the 100th monkey theory, that there's some kind of neo-telepathic tipping point in societies after which behaviors catch on. The 100th monkey is responsible for everything from fads to social mores to the death of the VCR. So why just one infinite monkey at a typewriter? Why not have 100 infinite monkeys? If the 100th monkey theory holds, when one of them writes Hamlet eventually, all of them will. Either that or we'll have 100 smashed typewriters. With that much time on your hands, breaking stuff is a lot more fun than writing. Believe me, I've been there. I gotta go.
Ian Scholes, the only man who can solve a philosophical problem in 60 seconds.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2008.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
Our production coordinator is Devin Strolovich. Daniel Elstein is our director of research. Lael Weiss is our webmaster. Also thanks to Zoe Corneli, Merle Kessler, Corey Goldman, and Mark Stone.
Philosophy Talk is sponsored in part by Powell City of Books, on the web at powells.com. Support also comes from the Templeton Foundation.
And from various groups at Stanford University, the Friends of Philosophy Talk, and the members of KALW San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed in this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.